helpful for the understanding. Introduction can be very short, since I'm the first speaker here, but I never try to do it. Basic question is appropriate for this nice institute here is, what is our universe made of? Of course, our interpretation of quintessence is a bit different from the Greek ones, and we can also be more quantitative today. We know it's about 3/4 of dark energy, 1/4 of matter, and I think everybody, all of us believe that. This is a bit strange, and we have we are still far from understanding where we go. Definitions, what is dark energy, is relatively simple if you come from the other side. You can define matter simply by everything that clumps, because everything that clumps produces a gravitational potential, that's we detect matter. And everything that does not clump is dark energy, and this is then by definition homogeneous. So this is type of working definition that is very convenient. We will later relate dark energy to a scalar field. Often the question comes, and if the scalar field is also clumping, that is in principle possible, but the part of the energy density in the scalar field that is clumping, we would just count it as matter. So the dark energy part is really only the homogeneous part, and as a direct consequence, it will not exert any force, because homogeneous, no direction is singled out, and you cannot detect it by any local experiment. Does not mean that you cannot detect the field that may be responsible for it by local experiment under certain circumstances. So now let me come playing to the key question, what is it? Is it static or dynamic? Is it a cosmological constant? Or quintessence. Today I want really to make a strong point that you should not decouple this question of quintessence from the problem of the cosmological constant. I know that there is a rather general attitude saying, okay, we have the cosmological constant problem, somebody has to set that for us to zero, and then we get an initial quintessence field, and we study its properties. This is, of course, for phenomenology, it is completely OK. If you think the problem a bit more on the theoretical side, on a more deeper side, I think it's very unsatisfactory if you separate both. I mean, in my view, if quintessence, dark energy, whatever model you have, to present has absolutely no answer to the question why the cosmological constant that you could also always have in addition, why that is zero, you simply didn't bring, you know, in a sense, much light into this basic question. So in terms of scalar potentials that many of you love, you can, of course, write a scalar potential, and often for quintessence fields, this scalar potential will relax to zero when the field grows large, something like that, like the exponential potential or inverse power law. But you have, of course, to explain why it relaxes to zero and why it does not relax to a constant. And this is a real critical issue. And in this talk, I want to address this particular question to a large extent. I think it's also important for the credibility of this field. After all, your favorite theory of quintessence has a strong competitor. And a strong competitor is a cosmological constant. After all observations are compatible with it. And in some way or another, you have to prove that you are better or at least as good as the cosmological constant in order to convince. Now, if you can bring some light into the question why the cosmological constant is so small, or maybe even vanishes asymptotically, then I think many people would be ready to say, okay, even though the model is not yet waterproof in all respects, it's certainly a very serious competitor to the cosmological constant. If your modal is so close to the cosmological constant, is very close to the cosmological constant, and in addition, it just introduces again a very small parameter, then, and this is very often so, then many people would say, why the hell should we come to a relatively complicated modal that has anyhow a small mass scale of, let's say, 10 to the power minus 3 electron volt, or a dimensionless parameter of the order 10 to the 100 or 10 to the power minus 100. Why the hell should we do this more complicated model if we can make a model that is much simpler, that is very straightforward? If you give me a small parameter from somewhere, I personally would always offer then just use it for a cosmological constant. That's by far the most simple. So the challenge, in a sense, is to find a situation where you have, at the end, a small parameter, but where you try to explain it. So similar, let's say, to QCD. You will, of course, still have to tune some couplings in order to get the scale small in QCD. The scale of strong interactions as compared to the unification scale is given by some exponential factor, e to the power minus 1 over the coupling constant. And of course, you have to find the right range of coupling constants such that this ratio comes out of 10 to the power minus 17. But it's the dependence is only logarithmic. And this would be a type of satisfactory solution. So some models fulfill that. Some models have more difficulties with that. So that was a long introduction. Now let me come to one particular idea how to understand this type of small ratios and how that may be related to quintessence. So let me just come back to this simple picture. Problem is clear, cosmological constant. If you give me the number, it explains, of course, the by now problem perfectly. It's just a question of these numbers. Here you have energy density in matter decreasing, here the cosmological constant. But you will always have the problem of explaining this 10 to the power minus 120 as compared to the reduced Planck mass. If you have quintessence or other modifications, let's say of gravity or whatever, you could find in a natural way, even though other modifications are actually often much more difficult, you would like to have a situation where quintessence has always a similar energy density as the matter density. They both decrease together. There's a recent overtaking such that today we have 70% of dark energy and not only, let's say, 5% as in early cosmology. But the order of magnitude would then be naturally explained, since the order, the ratio between dark energy and matter of radiation was always of the order 1. So this will be the challenge. Explain, if we come back to this red curve, explain why for quintessence field, why this goes asymptotically to zero, or if you have a good model where your potential finds a minimum, give a natural explanation why it settles at a value of 10 to the power minus 120 in units of the Planck scale. Okay, now my title related this problem to the fundamental scale, and that may be not so obvious at first sight why this issue, why the issue of how our universe is composed in terms of homogeneous and unhomogeneous and inhomogeneous energy density parts, why at all this is related to the simple but basic problem to understand our mass or length units. Typical problem, you get an answer, of course, always a dimensionless answer. Your computer will always give you, let's say, L equals to 5, and you have to think, okay, what is the unit? Is it meters? Is it inches? Is it light years? there's a very practical problem very often, actually, because we, as a theorist, we often forget about our units. But this basic problem is actually not so, you know, trivial as it might seem. This basic problem brings us back very quickly to quite fundamental issues to understand what are the basic properties of a fundamental scale in your theory. So first of all, a very direct relation that you may realize immediately is that if you ask what actually changes in time, normally you say the energy density changes in time. Huh? That is fine, but if you think about it a bit more closely, you have, of course, to ask in what units. And at the end, just as our computer gives only numbers, all physics has to be formulated only in terms of dimensionless ratios. There's never anything else that you can observe. You always can only observe dimensionless ratios. So what type of dimensionless ratio are we actually addressing when we speak about dark energy? Well, we speak about the ratio of the potential energy, let's say of a scalar field or some other ingredient. We speak about the ratio of this potential energy as compared to the fourth power of the Planck mass. Now that's a typical ratio that we really measure in gravitational, in let's say in cosmological situations. It's always this ratio. And that brings us, of course, immediately to a very simple issue. If it's only the ratio that is important, you may have, of course, both sides that could contribute to a change of this ratio. Could be that the potential changes, could also be that the Planck mass changes. It could be, for example, that both of them increase, but the Planck mass increases faster than the potential, and then the ratio would go to zero. And this is a typical type of situation that I want to explore with you today. So imagine we solve the cosmological constant problem by having a situation where the Planck mass varies in time, but it varies faster, it increases faster than the cosmological, than the potential energy, and that the ratio goes to zero, and I promise you that is enough to get a realistic cosmology. Yes, please.
So, two questions. How could it possibly solve the cosmological constant problem to have the Planck mass vary in time if the cosmological constant naturally is at the order of the Planck mass to the fourth?
Well, because the ratio may change. The ratio may change. Of course, in this, if you want to find a solution of this type, then you should find that this ratio is actually moving with time, and it's not always, it may be of the order 1 in very early cosmology, but if you wait long enough, it will be, for example, in this type of modules of the order 10.
Whatever happens to the ratio, there's a leading term, which is not a ratio, which is the Planck mass to the fourth, or if the supersymmetry is the supersymmetry breaking scale.
No, you will see that this is exactly not what happens. Otherwise, I would not say. That's the type of cosmological problem, constant problem. If you want, you can phrase it also in this way. If you have this ratio, you want, of course, if you were. You have a situation where these two evolve differently, that tells you that the potential is not just m plus to the fourth, otherwise it's constant by definition.
For example,
take g equal to zero, that would make the Planck mass change. Yeah, okay, let me go on a little bit. I think things will get more concrete if I develop the model, and then we can. Of course, I'm ready to take this discussion again. Fundamental mass scale. We all think the final issue of a fundamental mass scale has to be related in some way to unification of, let's say, our gauge interactions with gravity. We have explained velocity of light and the and h bar by special relativity and quantum theory. Somehow we want to explain also now a fundamental mass scale by some unification. But the issue is an open one. Is that scale a constant? Or is that scale dynamical? This is not a priori a settled question. No? It's not clear that the fundamental theory has to deliver us an additional constant. In some way it has to do, but this does not mean that it is built in a simple way that you have a mass constant appearing in your theory. You may also have the situation that actually the mass is really, the fundamental mass is really a dynamical quantity, which would mean, of course, the mass is, instead of being a fixed parameter, it will be given by a field. We know a good example of that, where it's almost the case, this is the standard model of electroweak interactions. All masses are given by the expectation value of the Higgs scalar. So if you vary this Higgs scalar, you vary all masses, and up to the fact that you still have a mass parameter in general that fixes this expectation value, or the mass parameter and the scalar potential, you do not have any other mass parameters in your theory. So the type of theory without a mass parameter at all, this would be something like the standard model where the scalar potential also does not have any mass parameter. Mass parameters are then often generated by dimensional transmutations, by quantum fluctuations, and this will indeed be a crucial issue that we will explore here.
So let me understand, so what are you keeping fixed? You should keep fixed something, right? Some dimensional ratio.
No, you don't need to keep fixed. Let's ask something different. What is varying? If your fundamental mass scale, what is varying? Well, the mass scale varies with respect to the coordinate or momentum frame.
No, I understand, but for me, I'm watching this, right? The mass of this Planck scale is constant or changing?
The mass scale will be the mass scale with respect to the Planck scale will be constant. I will come to that in a minute. No, wait. In a minute. In a minute, of course I obviously I thought about this question. Okay, yeah.
You understand my point?
You find it already here on this slide. So, okay, let me go. Let's just first construct this type of theory. It's principle, it's not difficult. So, what you want in the first approximation to have all your mass scales proportional to this scalar field. So not only the Planck mass, but also the proton mass, WCD, the W mass, and so on. So fundamental scale means if that fundamental scale moves in this first approximation, it means that all mass scales that you observe move simultaneously. So it's a question that you have to address is what will be the implications if all mass scales move simultaneously? Obviously, if there is an exact proportionality, you will not win anything in particular. But you may win if this exact proportionality gets destroyed by quantum corrections, by running cuttings, or something like that. So let me come back again to Gia's point. Of course, you really have to guarantee that your nucleon mass over the Planck mass must remain almost constant. This is a basic observation. Otherwise, you just run into very bad problems from the very early beginning. So this will be actually one of the main difficulties to guarantee that this is the case while the Planck scale, let's say, moves to infinity.
Yeah, but that's not enough. That's my point. Because if you keep that constant, then the partial radius of your proton goes to zero. And that we can measure.
No, the Schwarzschild radius is again only something given by the ratio.
No, Schwarzschild radius is that divided by m squared, and that goes to zero.
No. But it's again a dimension-full quantity. You have again, but you have to compare that again to some other scale, let's say to the Planck scale, and that of course.
No, I can fix that. I can form some other scale in that. There's no problem.
So which one? You always need a scale. That is my basic point. You always, every physical statement has to be made in terms of a dimensionless quantity.
So
Schwarzschild radius is the same. If you have to measure,
but you have other ways to measure the Schwarzschild radius.
So I can
take a photon of a given wavelength.
Okay.
Radio wave.
Okay. And how do you measure the wavelengths? You put it. Let's say you compare it with some atomic clock, and therefore you compare it to the electron mass.
No, I can compare it to the wavelength of the photon.
The wavelengths.
Two mirrors. I can bounce.
But how do you define how long that is?
That's how I define. I take two mirrors.
It's true, but the distance, you measure the distance. What is the distance between two mirrors?
Your speed of light is constant, right?
Yes. So.
Okay, so then if speed of light is constant, I can measure anything.
No, because you have to measure time as well. And how do you measure time? You use an atomic clock, you measure some frequency, and that is again in units of the electron mass.
No, if C is constant, right?
It's an important point.
C is constant, and speed of light is constant.
Yes,
then I can always measure any distance in light seconds.
And how do you measure light seconds? How do you measure seconds?
I put two mirrors and bound back and forth.
And how do you measure a second?
A second will be time between the clicks.
And how do, in what units do you measure seconds?
In that unit.
Not in that unit. You need a clock. In order to measure time, you need a clock.
But it's the following statement. Yeah. If I would change my theory in such a way that I would keep constant the ratios of all the masses of the particles,
yes,
like let's say proton mass to Planck scale, everything to Planck scale, I keep that constant.
Yes.
You would say that's unobservable.
That's unobservable.
No, that's not true.
That's unobservable. I will even explicitly construct you and show you that this is unobservable.
Because first of all, we also have other scales, like you see this scale, which has to do nothing with the proton mass. So
it has to do a lot with the proton mass, but
no.
Let's keep first the logic.
Okay.
If you have all scales moving together, then indeed I claim you would not be able to observe it. Actually, that I can even prove you mathematically. You can afterwards make a transition to an Einstein frame, and then all scales would just be constant.
Let me take this, or whatever chair. Mm-hmm. So keep the ratio of its mass to the Planck scale constant.
Yes.
And now make Planck scale smaller. Eventually, you will turn it into a platform.
The chair would move.
So it doesn't change time proportionally to the mass of the proton.
Of course it does.
Come
because
on.
Its size is determined by.
It's determined, but it's not proportional. I mean, it's a very complicated.
No, if it's as long as it's exactly.
It's determined by the Bohr radius.
Come on.
It's not determined by.
It's not proportional to the Bohr radius.
Of course it is. As long.
It's not proportional. So you are saying if I change the proton of the mass, the size of the chair just shrinks?
Yes. Of course. Yes.
Proportionally?
Yes. Of course. This is exactly the point. Since you can only see dimensionless ratios, all length scales will be inverse mass scales, and of course the length shrinks as the mass increases.
The standard model is not conformally invariant. I can do this mass changes by changing the expectation value of the x, and that's an observable effect in the standard.
Yeah, but then you change it, let's say, with respect to the lambda QCD, or you change it with respect to the Planck mass.
Exactly. Yeah, things do not go proportionally.
But
it's not that you just shrink the chair together.
No,
he's
having to play with the values of the coupling.
You have, of course.
Explain how play. The nature is not conformally invariant. That's not true. Right?
The point is
you cannot change.
Okay, I think let me make chairman here. I'm very much in favor of the discussion, but also I have sometimes to interrupt it because otherwise you will not get my points. And I think it's a very important discussion, and I'm very glad that it came up. Because it's a strong statement about which you have always to think carefully that indeed, and we will discuss, we will come certainly back to this question a little later, that indeed, if you would have a theory where all scales change exactly proportional to each other, this change would not be observable.
The to make this statement. But the statement that you only measure dimensionless quantities is a tautology. You keep looking into a loop.
Okay.
Which is what he said.
It's a true statement. Whatever it is, it is a true statement. Your computer, it's a true statement. All scientific statements will, at the end, be given in terms of only dimensionless number, dimensionless ratios, and not depend on some scale unit that you set in, unless this scale unit, gains some particular importance.
So, Christoph, that's absolutely true. Let me debate my statement, and I will go. Of course, we measure everything in dimensionless units, but those dimensionless units, they are not just proportional to one particular scale that you are changing. They are highly nonlinear. The sizes depend nonlinear on different things, and the statement is simply that we know that even if
it's not nonlinear.
Standard model is not conformal.
It's not nonlinear. Units, when all units scale, when all mass scales scale together, this is a completely linear problem. Because the nonlinearity is only in the dimensionless constants, in the dimensionless ratios, and they do not affect it.
Okay, so then let me ask one question, and now I really. Okay, you are saying, let me completely ignore the fact here, gravity, switch off gravity. This is not a question about gravity. Okay, take standard model. Okay? Mm-hmm. So this standard model, I can change the expectation value of the Higgs.
Yes.
And all the masses, they change proportionally.
Yes.
All the ratios of all the quark masses and W mass, everything is proportional.
Yes.
So are you saying that in standard model, that change is unobservable? So if I would take Higgs expectation value to infinity, I would get exactly the same nature. That's what you are saying?
If you take at the same time number QCD to infinity, and you do not do any gravitational experiment, not something like falling down, because then indeed it would be equivalent. You could not measure it.
Yeah, but you cannot. That's the problem, right? You cannot take lambda QCD. If I change the expectation value of the Higgs, that changes proportionally all the masses. It should agree in the standard model. But that's an observable effect, right? We know that the expectation value of the Higgs is not.
But now you are. Now you are challenging the question if we can have these exactly proportional to each other. That's a completely different question.
Yeah.
For the moment, I was just saying if they are all proportional to each other, you will not be able to determine that they evolve or that they do not evolve. If this proportionality, and this will be a key issue, is not given exactly, then you can observe. And this will be where quintessence will appear.
Right, but you need not only that proportionality, you need also the mass of the chair is proportional to the same size.
This is given, I assure you, if you think it's true, if there's only one mass scale in your theory, your mass of the chair is given proportional to the Planck scale, whatever it is.
Of course, but
okay, now we stop, because otherwise I will not go on. No? Okay, so in order to realize it, just to fix your idea, what could this field chi be? Maybe, for example, a typical scale of a transition of some unified theory of everything, whatever it is, from higher dimensions to four dimensions, or something similar. So you may be able to associate that with a very concrete scale at the end. So now let's first look at such a theory that has no fundamental scale, and I give you here a simple one. I just use gravity and a scalar field. Now, since we do not have an explicit scale, of course, a Planck scale has to be replaced by the second power of the scalar field. So this is actually also fixing the normalization field of the scalar field. It's always normalized such that its coefficient, in quantity curvature scalar is a constant. Of course, in this case, you have in general not a simple kinetic term. I have here parameterized it in this particular way. I'll tell you immediately why. Now, since all masses are proportional to chi, they will be of the order of some dimension less constant, which will, for the proton, must be, of course, a very small constant, times this scalar field chi. And you get a potential.
But the potential has to be very restricted.
One moment. I cannot give everything at once.
I have
so
time limit.
Now I go first a little bit straight, and then we come back to the discussion part. Okay, So two little points, this field chi typically has to be a gauge signal, so it has no gauge interactions. And its status, maybe it's a fundamental field. This is what we, in practice, here explore. It's not really important. It's some degree of freedom that you typically obtain after integrating out your other degrees of freedom. For example, in a realistic theory, you have, of course, more than one scalar field. So chi would then just denote the direction in the relative minimum with respect to all scalar fields. So it would just flow along a valley in the theory space. So now let's come again to this potential I have to specify. So let's first realize the full scale invariance. The full scale invariance, what you need is a potential that is given by lambda times chi to the 4. Otherwise, the potential must have dimension mass to the 4. So here you have a dimensionless constant. And the full scale invariance is guaranteed if lambda is a constant, delta is a constant, and h is a constant. So this would be the theory. If that would be the case, then all scales would really be exactly proportional to chi. And this is the theory where I would pretend you cannot observe if chi moves or not. Just one other little remark, the fact that I used this particular normalization here for the kinetic term with this minus 6 is simply due to the fact that delta equals 0 is singled out. This is a special point where the theory has conformal symmetry and not only dilatation symmetry.
Isn't it anomalous though? The conformal symmetry of this theory?
It is a particular theory, you would get, of course, an anomaly. Nevertheless, you can convince yourself that this will be a fixed point of flow equations. That is why this point is still singled out. What happens actually, I'm even not sure if it is anomalous. What happens actually is that chi decouples as a degree of freedom in the limit when delta is equal to 0. So the theory has just one degree of freedom less. Actually never thought if it's anomalous or not. Maybe not. It will not be central. Okay, now this would be a boring story. The really interesting part comes when you include quantum fluctuations and when you explore the possibility that these couplings may actually depend on scale. Depending on scale, you can either have them depending on some renormalization scale. You can also write that directly by a dependence of these couplings on the logarithm of the field here. Since this is the only scale, all dependence will finally depend on some ratio of chi over mu, where mu is some arbitrary renormalization scale. And you can express your beta functions just directly in the Pohlmann-Weinberg type as the running of your couplings with respect to chi. So now I'm making one really important hypothesis. I'm making the hypothesis that the running of these quartic couplings has a fixed point at lambda equals to 0, and the deviation of this fixed point is given by an anomalous dimension. Let me issue a little warning for you. Don't swallow that too easily. That seems not to be so dramatic here. But if you give me that, then I solve you the cosmological constant problem. So this will be a very central part of the hypothesis. So let's quickly think if that's reasonable. First of all, the potential went like lambda chi to the 4. So when lambda would cross from positive to negative values as chi increases, this would tell that your theory switches from a stable theory to an unstable theory. So this has never been observed in any consistent, self-consistent theory, and it should certainly not happen in any real unified theory, because the theory should, of course, be consistent at all scales. So in that case, from that perspective, I think it seems relatively rather natural that any consistent theory must have a fixed point at lambda equals to zero, simply because you cannot cross by a simple renormalization flow from stable to unstable. What is less?
Exactly the behavior you just described happens in the standard model. If you set
in the standard model, it happens like that. But in the standard model, if you would just have a pure scalar theory, you would get actually that in, you get not an anomalous dimension, but you get something like A lambda squared. But this is something that is very particular to four dimensions. For example, doesn't hold in three dimensions, doesn't hold in five dimensions. It's a particularity in four dimensions related in a statistical physics sense to the fact that four is the upper critical dimension for such five to four theories. So in the standard model, this would not be realized. There would be a lambda squared here. But let's explore, that is actually for most statistical systems, for most many-body systems, is actually a pretty generic situation. Let's explore what happens if that is given by an anomalous dimension.
Before you do, what about the other couplings? Does H also got to be zero at that fixed point?
The small h?
Yeah, is the statement that lambda equals zero the fixed point even though h is not zero?
Yes, this is a non-trivial part. Because in the standard model, we get also contributions where we have here, for example, something like h to the 4.
Yeah.
But again, you know, this would drive, if a fundamental theory would have this property, this would imply that the renormalization flow brings you from a stable to an unstable theory, which is actually, I think, not self-consistent.
But this is very much the anomaly story, right? Because you've got a very, very flat pendulum, lambda 0, then you're asking any small perturbation, when you change it. And scale invariant, even with scale invariant, the lambda phi is tied to the board of scale invariant, but then changing lambda, having lambda flow away from zero is an extremely strong statement.
It may flow away from zero, it may flow towards zero. It may flow towards zero. So let's explore that, but we'll phrase it a little bit differently on the next slide. I just have also this type of flow equation that for the moment we omit. We'll come back to that later.
Question, this is an ultraviolet stable fixed point?
Or this is an ultraviolet fixed point that is stable when chi goes to the ultraviolet. You see it here.
So that's the opposite of what you expect from perturbation theory. I mean, there is an infrared stable fixed point for lambda 5.4.
This is true. So but don't forget that this is a pure statement that is always based in four dimensions. If you go to higher dimensions, it will not be true.
But it's also in with the gravitational couplings, time and perturbation theory remains.
It's by far not a trivial statement. If it would be so trivial, I would present you a little model where I just compute and tell you, look here, this is a type of fixed point behavior. I don't have such a model, and I will actually show you that it's not so easy to get it because it really needs the understanding of what the final unified theory is. You cannot guess that from our knowledge of the low energy effective theory. So for the moment, let's just continue with this assumption and explore.
If it depended on the details of the unified theory, then the leading coefficient would depend on other couplings. The fact that that's your hypothesis is only proportional lambda means if I set all the other couplings to zero, I still have an ultraviolet stable fixed point for lambda 5.4 theory, which we just know is not true.
It's not true in four dimensions, let me repeat it.
This is a four-dimensional calculation?
No, but this is not a four-dimensional calculation. I will come back to that in a minute, what you would really have to compute if you do the computation. You will see it is not determined by four-dimensional physics.
Can you imagine going up or down?
It's going up with respect to our four-dimensional world, but with respect to the higher dimensional unified theory, the scale chi will actually be the infrared scale. If the scale chi makes the difference, makes the transition from the higher dimensional regime to the effective four-dimensional regime, so if you look at it from our four-dimensional world, it looks ultraviolet. But if you look at it from the higher dimension, from the unifying point of view, it is actually the infrared scale that matters. Since at the end it will be the momentum fluctuations, the fluctuations with momentum of the order of chi, of the order of transition, it is not a four-dimensional problem how to compute this anomalous dimension. Otherwise, of course, it would be very simple. Okay, I think it was a good thing to realize how that you know, how central this statement here is, that this is by far not proven. Otherwise, I would claim I have solved the cosmological constant. But if you can find a theory that has this property, it solves the cosmological constant problem.
So far, we are discussing some polynomials, right?
Yes.
But we agree that there's a fundamental step to approach a standard model, which is not dissipation invariant or performance invariant, which is another scale.
No, but let me come to that again. You will get your standard model at the end, or at least the typical ingredients. The standard model will depend essentially. Let me take off this standard. You give me a hot time, so. Okay, still okay? Okay. Let's come back to the standard model a little later. Let me first now make the main the main cosmological points, and then we discuss a bit later these issues. So the different way of phrasing is we make a statement on how the scalar potential behaves when chi increases. This will be the only relevant question. Oops. So if lambda goes, this is anomalous dimension. Now the potential goes like chi to the 4 times this anomalous contribution here. And that means that the potential increases with chi to the power 4 minus a. So the statement is actually, you will be in business if you can show that the scalar potential does not increase precisely like chi to the 4, but it increases with, let's say, chi squared, or chi to the 3.8, or whatsoever. And of course, a mass scale comes now in through the renormalization effects. This is a scale mu. Maybe at the end even appear very simply. You could have, for example, mu squared times chi squared, or something like that. You could add, simply have a theory where the potential is constant. Whatever you have, the only thing you need, the only crucial thing you need, it's not much, it's not so much as it seems, is that your potential for large values of chi increases less fast than chi to the 4. You can add to this theory now a cosmological constant, a mass term, whatever you you want. This will not matter because at the end, the only thing that will matter is the behavior when chi goes to very large values, and then of course you become insensitive to the lower ones. So now I have to discuss a bit the question of quantum fluctuations, because quantum fluctuations in quintessence models are not very often discussed, and they're also discussed often in a way that which is not necessarily reflecting the complete story. The reason is that quantum fluctuations actually depend very crucially on in what frame you compute them. You know that, for example, this frame that I'm using here, this dilatation invariant setting, this is usually called the Jordan frame. And there's also the Einstein frame where you have your scales fixed. So all these frame changes are completely equivalent as long as you only look at your effective field equations derived from your effective theory after integrating out the quantum fluctuations. But for the quantum fluctuation themselves, it is crucial to define in which frame you compute, because you can make a transition in the functional integral, but that makes you a very complicated Jacobian that you can never do in practice. So now, let's think about, we want now to, not really to compute quantum fluctuations, but at least to get a feeling what quantum fluctuations do, because they should be responsible for these quantum couplings. So the first thing is that if you want to compute it, you cannot compute it from four dimensions. You really need a unified theory, and this is, of course, the bad news, because we do not have these unified theories in such an easy way. But to convince you very quickly, you can see that the dominant contributions, they come from momentum modes that are of the same order of magnitude as chi, because lower momentum modes, they will be suppressed. For example, if you look at momentum modes that have only, let's say, momentum 10 to the power minus 10 times chi, they will be suppressed by a factor 10 to the power minus 40, because typically contributions to the potential come with a fourth power, for given momentum range, come with a fourth power of the momentum. So it's really an issue where you have to, where you need the understanding of the fluctuations with momenta of the order of chi, and chi, I remind you, will be the effective Planck scale. So you really need the momenta of the order of the unification scale, or otherwise saying you need to understand the infrared behavior of some unknown unified theory. And this is, of course, where this nice idea is often blocked in practice, or it is blocked in practice, because one doesn't have a unified theory, and so you may go now for some simple, try to have some simple toy models for unified theories, up to you to try to realize it. What you should not do is having any prejudice about what you would infer from, let's say, QCD momenta or something like that. These are absolutely tiny contributions when it comes to the question of how the potential behaves for large chi, simply because the relative of it is true, of course, if you change chi, you will also change, let's say, your lambda QCD, you will change your Fermi scale, so this change also contributes. There is a four-dimensional contribution from the scale, from the change of these scales to the total change with chi, but it is suppressed with respect to the generic contributions by the fourth power of the small coupling, between, I have an hour and a half. So it will be suppressed by this small coupling, and therefore it's actually a negligible contribution. Nevertheless, you remind me that I should go a little bit faster. Okay, so let's now just explore what such a potential that increases less fast than chi to the 4, what that will actually do. It will produce you already a relatively realistic cosmology, because what will now happen is chi will actually increase in time. This may be at first sight surprising. You normally have the attitude that the scalar field always runs to the minimum of the potential, which would be at chi equals to 0. But since it's coupled to gravity, the scalar field runs actually up the potential. It increases in cosmology. So cosmology, from a four-dimensional point of view, explores what happens if your ultraviolet scale becomes bigger and bigger, or, of course, from a higher dimensional point of view, when the infrared scale becomes bigger and bigger. So the scalar field runs up. This is why you only need the behavior for large values of chi. And now you see immediately that if the potential increases less fast than chi to the 4, the ratio of the potential divided by the fourth power of the Planck mass will decrease to 0, because the effective Planck mass is given by chi in our model. So for large time, the effective cosmological constant will vanish asymptotically. Very simple calculation. Potential divided by fourth power of the Planck mass goes exactly. This is a anomalous dimension. And when chi increases to infinity, that will go to 0.
So can you explain again why chi is increasing?
Why chi is increasing, you just have to solve the coupled field equations for the scalar field and gravity, and you find it's increasing.
Okay.
I give you another explanation in the next slide that may make it much simpler why it is increasing. Because if for the actual solution of cosmological equations, you can do it, of course, in this frame. But once you have your theory, I was arguing you can now do a change of frame. And then for the actual solution, it's actually much simpler to do the Weyl scaling and to change from the Jordan to the Einstein frame. So that you do by multiplying your metric with a function of the scalar field. You also change units for your scalar field phi, just takes a log. And in these new variables, these new coordinates, your action looks very familiar. Your action looks m squared r, so chi squared r, but it's translated by Weyl scaling to m squared r. You get a kinetic term for your scalar field. You get a potential. You get in principle mass terms. Now, what is important, your potential in this case is computable, and it is exactly m to the 4 times exponential minus pi over m. So that is, for example, one simple reason where an exponential potential comes from. It is in the Jordan frame. It just comes whenever your potential increases, not exactly like chi to the 4, but with some other power. After Weyl scaling, you find a potential that decreases exponentially. And now the important point, it decreases exponentially, but it decreases exponentially to 0, not to a constant. And that is clear that it has to do that, because we have already seen in the Jordan frame that the ratio of cosmological constant over the fourth power of the Planck scale goes to 0 for large time. Now, of course, this is a dimensionless statement, so it's the same in all frames. And if you look at this statement in the Weyl frame, it means that your potential has to go to 0, because your Planck scale in the Weyl frame, in the Einstein frame, is of course a fixed constant, and the ratio can only go to 0 now if the potential goes to 0. It's very simple to understand. You can, of course, just compute that this is actually what happens. But here is, for example, a good reason why you can solve, how you could solve the cosmological constant problem in a setting with the dilatation anomaly for this potential. Yes, please?
But if you go, if you define another phi such that k disappears in your action, what's the actual formula of the potential?
K is the kinetic term. This is linked to the running of this other, of this kinetic term for chi. If the kinetic term for chi is just a constant, k would just be a constant. If the kinetic term for chi has also some evolution with chi, k will be not a constant.
Okay, Chris, the question was if you will normalize kinetic term canonically, how potential will be changed?
Well, in the simplest form where well, the kinetic term for chi is just a constant, then this k is a constant, and then of course the scaling is trivial.
But
I will
calculable or not in this model?
It is of, when you have. I come to that in 3 or 4 slides. Okay, now we can also understand a little bit better this issue about observability. You see when. There is a special point when the potential is exactly like chi to the 4. In this case, the potential of phi would be an exact constant. It would be flat. In this case, you would reproduce the cosmological constant. So what does that mean? That simply means that if dilatation symmetry would be an exact symmetry, this exact symmetry would be broken now by the expectation value of the scalar field chi, correspondingly by phi. But if you break a global symmetry spontaneously, you will get a Goldstone boson. And phi is exactly the Goldstone boson. So if you have an exact symmetry, the potential has to be flat as it comes out, because it's a Goldstone boson. But you also would find in terms of, if you have an exact dilatation symmetry, then your mass term would also be just a constant, and you would see that at the end, you just come a theory that completely looks normal up to an additional field that is massless and it just has a kinetic term up to a Goldstone boson. You would indeed not be able to observe this Goldstone boson, and this would be not such an interesting theory, but it's an interesting limiting case, because now you realize what happens if you have quantum fluctuations. Now your Goldstone boson is not an exact Goldstone boson anymore. You acquire the field, the scalar field requires a potential, it's a so-called pseudo-Goldstone boson, and now, of course, this scalar field has some non-trivial dynamics, and this field is what I called at the time a cosmon. Maybe since I'm advanced in time, I will not discuss the quantum fluctuations again here in detail. We may come back in a discussion to that point. Let me just reiterate that very often it is stated that quantum fluctuations are a problem for quintessence models. In this type of formulation, it's just the opposite. Quantum fluctuations are the origin of the non-trivial potential for the cosmon. So in a sense, quantum fluctuations are the origin of the solutions to the cosmological constant problem, to a non-trivial potential, and to dynamical dark energy. Let me go on. Let me take the fixed point discussion, which is an interesting one. Let me take up if you ask me at the end or during coffee break. So now we have this exponential potential. Let's look at the consequences of it. So the first consequence in the limit where this k here varies only very slowly is a very simple cosmology. If k would be a constant, you would find a cosmology where asymptotically the potential decreases with the second power of time, which means that the fraction in dark energy would go to a constant. So this is exactly what we were aiming for at the beginning. We would have a cosmology where at all times the fraction in dark energy, the dark energy component was of the same, was in comparison to the matter and radiation component, was a given constant. So for the solution of the naturalist problem of to explain the 10 to the power minus 120, this is exactly what we need. It's not yet a realistic cosmology, I will come to that in a moment, but it would explain really these small numbers. If omega h is a comes out a constant, and this is the case for this simple realization of a model, then the naturalist problem is solved, then we get, of course, a very simple explanation for this number 10 to the power minus 120 that always appears when we speak about dark energy. Well, we know that this, we have, of course, small numbers that we can explain naturally. One of these small numbers is the matter density in units of the Planck mass. It's also 3.5 times 10 to the power minus 121. There nobody worries about the small number. Why? Yeah, because this quantity is time dependent. It just decreases, and if you wait long enough, this number will be small enough. And the age of the universe today is just huge in units of the Planck time. There's a factor of 10 to the 60, and if you square it, you get 10 to the power minus 120. It is as simple. And the idea, of course, if you have this constant omega h, is that the homogeneous part just decreases with roughly the same power, and then, of course, you should not be surprised that it is of the same order that, again, you produce a very small number. So that's the basic idea. That is not completely good enough, but at least it was a genuine prediction at the time that in these type of models you expect a fraction of the energy budget of the universe that is in form of homogeneous contribution. It was a genuine prediction. It was also not not something, you know, where you put out an idea and then you put out a few ideas in all other senses. I think I really believed at the time that this would happen. I wrote other papers on that. It is, of course, also true that if you would have told me at the time that it's 70%, I would have told you never. I would say, well, natural solution of this time it's 10% or 20%. This is compatible, that was compatible with early cosmology at the time, but it was for me, just as for anybody else, a big surprise that it is 70%, and you will have to do some additional work if you really want to go to a realistic cosmology where you will get as much dark energy as it is observed. So the essential modification is that we know that in early cosmology, we cannot have more than, let's say, 5% of dark energy. In late cosmology, we need 70. So a completely constant omega H is not good enough. It has to increase more or less in recent time, let's say, after structure formation. And I just give you very quickly one realization how you could do that. For example, if we go now to this other equation, remember there was also this coefficient of the kinetic term that typically would also have a non-trivial flow equation. It should have a zero at the conformal fixed point, so when delta is zero, it should have a zero. If this, let me just make just for a little demonstration, if this would be a constant now, not times delta, but times delta squared, you actually get, after you count, after you do all computations, you get a kinetic term that increases when phi goes to a critical value. This is an equation, you know, just like, let's say, the beta function of QCD, where the coupling constant increases at a characteristic scale. So if this characteristic scale would be today, so that needs, of course, tuning. This value of phi, where it increases, should be 276 in units of the Planck scale, so you need a couple of per mil tuning, then actually you would really have a characteristic change in cosmology in the present epoch, and such a theory actually would give you even a realistic cosmology. It gives you this type of crossover quintessence, and I have just drawn you here a typical curve, so you have your equation of state goes to minus one recently, and you have a recent overtaking from only a couple of percent of early dark energy to 70% today. It's
so why it's increasing, Christian? Why there is this dependence? You write something like interfunction equations there? Or
yes, if you have this type. If you have this type of beta function, this would, of course, lead to an increase. It's, again, an assumption. It's an hypothesis. I'm not believing particular that. I only want to demonstrate here that you can get it relatively easily. This is one of the simplest beta functions that you can imagine, since it has, again, to have a zero at the conformal fixed point, delta equals to zero. If that goes like delta squared, it just has these properties that the running now produces a scale. That's actually different between an anomalous dimension, that the running does not produce a genuine scale, and evolution equation with delta square, where you get two-dimensional transmutation and where it produces a scale.
And if you would retranslate this dependence in the potential, how potential would it change?
What? At phi c, doesn't the kinetic energy that the phi field...
No, it just increases, of course. This will be only true for small values of delta. Of course, once delta is very large, here, this beta function will be something different.
Does that k squared equals 1 over 2e?
Yeah, this just reflects it, just as in lambda QCD. There's, of course, a scale where your coupling increases to infinity, but at that scale, you should, of course, modify your beta function.
But is phi supposed to pass through phi c?
No. Just, for example, modify that for large delta, that it goes to a constant or whatever it does, then, of course, you will, this is why I put these quotation marks here. It increases fast at this scale, but what it does then, if it stays, for example, just a big value, or if it increases further but without reaching infinity, that's another question. Actually, when k goes to infinity, this would just freeze your scalar field completely. This would... phenomenologically, your model would then just look like a cosmological constant.
At least. So that's how you satisfy fifth force capacity
and stuff like that? No, fifth force, I didn't speak about it. I don't think I can cover over everything.
Hello, I just asked him to understand. This field is light today, right?
This scalar field is always light today.
It's coupled
because it's an exponential potential, so the mass term is small. Let me go on a little bit. I think for the last quarter of an hour, I will now not take any questions, and you get your questions at the end. Okay, so this simple modification gives you crossover quintessence. This is, of course, only one model among many models. I do not want to go now into too many details. If you ask me what is the quintessence of quintessence, I think is that you get a dynamical evolution due to some scalar field, where both the potential and the kinetic term of this Cosman field contributes to the energy density, which is, of course, homogeneous. The phi only depends on time. So it gives you this variable dark energy density. And what is, of course, important, it's a scalar field, but a scalar field that still varies in the present cosmological epoch. Otherwise, would be like equation or the Higgs scalar, where the dynamics of the scalar field is not relevant anymore today. And there's a direct consequence of it, namely that you also have a very tiny and time-varying mass, because if your potential is more or less exponential, then you can compute your mass, and it is of the order of the Hubble parameter, and that tells you you get a new long-range interaction in addition to graviton, and to the graviton at very long distances. You would get a type of fifth force, the Cosmon, and you would have now not four, but five fundamental interactions. The dynamics is now, for the detailed dynamics, is given by this kinetic term. You always can choose units for your scalar field such that the potential is exactly exponential minus pi, in units of the Planck mass. I put the Planck mass here to one. So all the dynamics is in this kinetic k of phi. And this is actually also a very useful quantity in order to discuss models. You can, of course, reformulate all models with a standard potential, at least if the potential is monotonic, and put everything in this k of phi. And then you see also immediately how to realize now qualitative changes in cosmology, because if, as long as this k of phi is a small and almost constant, you find that the attractor solutions, that the cosmology is attracted to solutions where omega h remains constant. And if that remains true for most of the evolution of the universe, then during all that time, dark energy decreases. Now, if you make then later a transition to a cosmology where k becomes large, then actually the character of the solution changes. There's a new type of asymptotic solution. And this is now a Cosmon-dominated universe like inflation. And that tells you already it's relatively easy to construct realistic models by just having this k of phi changing from a small value during all early cosmology to a large value in relatively recent time. And then you're bound to get a cosmology that more or less looks familiar. I have given you one example. So actually, if you can also rephrase it in this way, you would, if you now trace the fraction in dark energy as a function of redshift, these type of models would typically have some constant small fraction in early cosmology, and then a certain transition to an increase where omega goes to very to large values, close to one typically, in a relatively recent time. And this is actually this type of curve. I always want to make this point stronger, even here, perhaps a phenomenological point. It is this type of curve that you want to measure. You want to find out not only how this curve behaves in the immediate vicinity of z equals zero, that is what you can parameterize easily by your equation of state, but you really want also to know, do you have this couple of percent of early dark energy, or don't you have that? Once you know this curve, omega of z, you get, of course, immediately w of z as a derivative. W of z is nothing else than just a logarithmic derivative of this function. So you see, of course, as long as omega h is constant, w is essentially zero. And when it increases strongly, w comes close to minus one. And this was actually also the point I made yesterday when we discussed this recommendation of measuring only W as a function of A, if you have just a derivative of this curve, it's just very hard to reconstruct the rest of this curve. You will just with a derivative have a hard time to know if it goes here to 3% or to 1% or to 10%. It's much better to parameterize directly this curve, since this is what you actually observe in your observations. So my plaidoyer is forget about set-dependent W. You get that later as a derivative. Look directly at the set-dependence of the function in dark energy. Perhaps a few remarks on this coincidence problem. Namely, the question, why is this transition from low values, low constant values of omega h to a sudden increase, why that happens now, more or less after structure formation. There are, of course, two possibilities in principle. One is that this is a modal property. If it's a modal property, that would be like, for example, explaining a scale like lambda QCD. You would explain it by logarithmic running. And I've already given you an example with this type of evolution equation for delta. And then you have, of course, a simple, you have in principle two regimes for quintessence. You have one late quintessence where W is close to minus one. If you would extrapolate back that to early cosmology, omega h would be negligible in early cosmology, but you have also the other regime of early quintessence, where omega h changes only modestly, so you can explain the order of magnitude. But now, of course, in order to connect this to that, you have a W that that changes in relatively recent time at such a transition moment. A second possibility is that this transition is actually not triggered by parameters in your fundamental theory, but it is rather triggered by some particular event in cosmology. And one of my favorite ones is actually structure formation that triggers this transition by a back reaction effect. And even though the back reaction effect is, I think, in my view, is tiny for pure gravitational back reaction, it may be much more substantial due to the nonlinearities in the scalar potential if you have such a Postman field. But this is only very little explored. And I think one of the big challenges for observations would really be try to find out if there is this early dark energy or not, give a number on it. We have, of course, already quite some information because early dark energy both modifies the background evolution, it modifies even CMB, and it slows down the structure. So if you have a few percent of early dark energy, the power spectrum for a lambda CBM model and the model with a little bit of early dark energies, they would look distinguishably different. And if you just make Monte Carlo analysis, multi-parameter analysis, of WMAP plus WMAP data here in yellow, plus all sorts of SDSS, non supernovae, and so on, combined data in blue. You can, of course, now analyze a lot of different quintessence models that have or do not have early quintessence and determine how much average, what is the average of dark energy during the time of structure formation, and you typically get bounds in the couple of percent limit. So it's already pretty much constrained. And what we even did, we tried a binning. So we just, this function omega h of z, we just binned it at z equals 1,000, 100, 10, I think 3 and 1, and of course 0. And if you just do a full analysis of all presently available data, you find these limits here. And interestingly enough, if you look at the cosmological constant, which is of course completely negligible at early time, and you compare this with this data, you are surprised how well the cosmological constant is already tested. It is already there is not so much room for early dark energy. There's just a couple of percent. That's the most you can have, which is, I take questions now only at the end, which is which is not completely irrelevant, because even a couple of percent will, for example, easily generate a factor of 3 or 4 in the number of clusters at early redshift. So it is definitely still something that is very important for the understanding of the details of structure formation in our universe. But we see already it cannot deviate too strongly from what a cosmological constant does, which is, of course, a pity. Would have been much nicer if the data would already have given some indication for early dark energy. Five minutes. Okay, I wanted to give you at the end a little instructive example of a higher dimensional theory that is not completely scale invariant, that has a scale, but where you can see actually the problems that arise when you want to construct on a basic fundamental theory level such realization of these ideas. Let me go very quickly through that. I think the main points, I can make them in 5 minutes. So what it is simply a six-dimensional gravity theory, six-dimensional constant. You have also a Maxwell term, just a gauge field. So this is, in this case, of course, not a scale-free theory. And let's just look what are the solutions of this theory, and write down the field equations, and let's just look what are the solutions if you have a particular ansatz, and this particular ansatz, it respects a four-dimensional homogeneous, it's four-dimensional homogeneous and isotropic, so that's, of course, the type of universe we want. And the internal space has a U1 symmetry and actually also a Z2 symmetry, and the metric is of this form. You would see, find if this B here is just 1, the internal space would just be a sphere. For B equals different from 1, it is one of these football-shaped internal geometries, or geometry with two planes sitting at singularities. And now you can easily find that the field equations with this ansatz of the metric transform into simple field equations for a scalar field. And if you compute the corresponding scalar field, it is exactly again of this type of an exponential potential. And if you now start with a large number for relatively arbitrary initial conditions, there is some criterion for them, then you will find that late cosmology only the linear, the first order in this potential contributes, and you find really in these models that the cosmological constant goes to zero. Let me emphasize that there is not any particular value of parameters, neither integration constants that I've chosen here. This happens for arbitrary values of our fundamental parameters. This happens for arbitrary values of my initial conditions, of my three integrations constants, everything. So it's really a genuine solution that in this case, really phi goes to zero, and you would get a cosmology that very much looks like a quintessence cosmology. So it would be very nice, but this points you to the real problem of these theories, namely, little remarks inside. After all, since I'm not speaking often about that, actually, this model kind of goes back to similar models in, I think, 85. Very often you have today discussion about warping brains and so on. And some of you may be surprised if you look back in this old work that there were actually already discussions on the bulk geometry of brains, as you would call it today, or warping in relatively realistic models, but that was just a little side remark. Now let's come really the asymptotic solution. Is really a cosmology that doesn't have a cosmological constant. The Hubble parameter really decreases inversely proportional to t, and this for arbitrary initial conditions, and there is actually in this case really no tuning whatsoever. So from the pure cosmological point of view, this would be a perfect solution of the cosmological constant problem. It has, however, a particle physics problem. Namely, it has a particle physics problem of time-varying fundamental constants. And this comes from the fact that in this particular model, not all particle physics scales vary proportional to the Planck scale, or if you want, in expressed differently, the dimensionless couplings, like the gauge coupling of the remaining gauge symmetry in four dimensions, that they also depend on the scalar field, and that they depend too strongly on the scalar field. And the constraints are really strong. I plot you here a recent result that we have obtained with Thomas Dent and Steffen Stern, a systematic study of primordial abundances as a function of a variation of couplings. What you see here are three unified theories, different assumptions on how the Fermi scale varies with respect to the QCD scale. And what is in black here are the W map results given the determinations of omega B, so with the variation that goes from here to here for the W map results within sigma. You see it works perfectly with the observed values of helium and deuterium. Lithium, there is some 2 sigma away. And you see you only a relatively small variation of fundamental coupling constants, like in this case a fine structure constant, has already a relatively drastic effect on nuclear synthesis. In particular, for example, it can bring lithium easily to the observed value. But this can also be interpreted if you say, okay, this is just systematics for the moment of the observation. This can be interpreted in a rough estimate how little the fundamental constants can actually vary. And you find typically, even if you go back to nuclear synthesis, it's numbers of the order 10 to the power minus 4 or 10 to the power minus 3, let's say. So there's not much space for time-varying coupling constants. And this is now independent of chameleon effects and similar. And unfortunately, this little six-dimensional model that I presented you has exactly a variation of coupling constant that is too strong. You can now do dimensional reduction. Look in four dimensions, you get a gauge theory. You can compute the gauge couplings and the renormalized gauge couplings. They also change exponentially with phi. And as a result, you get an unacceptable theory. The lesson from that, and I think I will close with that, is it's not particularly hard to realize this idea that the Planck mass increases faster than the potential. To realize that, that's relatively straightforward, and the simple six-dimensional model that I have presented you realizes already this idea. The real challenge is to guarantee the same time that all particle physics scales move almost proportional to the Planck scale. Now I'm back to Gia's point, in a sense, because if that is not realized, you would, of course, get strong problems with our chairs and so on. And only if you can manage that all dimensionless particle numbers in particle physics, including ratios, let's say, of photon mass compared to the Planck mass, only if they move only very little, then you will be able to construct a model that is not only viable from the cosmological point of view, but also from the particle point of view. And unfortunately, I cannot give you any concrete realization of that. And many questions, of course, remain, but I think I'm now in my time, and I thank you for your long attention.
Anybody, except Sophia, have questions? It seems to me that your cosmology That's a very significant fine-tuning. The mass is 10 to minus 33 electron volts. So you'll probably never see it observationally. So it seems to me the Gosman joins being one of these effective fields. And what you get really the result of a fundamental theory which we don't know yet. In particular, rocket car which we said you can convert in great time in a homogeneous solution to accelerate the universe into an effective field. And I don't agree, by the way, that such an inhomogeneous solution, which gives a small contribution to the back reaction. Because even though the gravitational potential is small, delta rho over rho is 5 or 10. And this is a highly nonlinear problem. So,
okay, maybe we are not discussing everything at once, because now you are making a total picture of cosmology. So let's go to the mass, because you have alluded to the question of the naturalness of the mass. This comes out, actually, the argument for that is very, very simple. I mean, once you get this type of fixed point behavior, and as a consequence, this exponential potential, which is then really due to the quantum fluctuations, this gives you, of course, directly the answer what the mass is, because the mass is given by the second derivative of the potential. And if you now look at this particular language with this formulation where you have a standardized potential, so the potential is always e to the power minus pi, and you have your modal dependence only appearing in terms of this kinetic term k of phi. In this language, it's also particularly simple to compute the mass. So if your k would be 1, the mass would just be the second derivative of the potential. Now, for a non-standard kinetic term, the mass squared is given by the second derivative of the potential divided by k squared. And that's, of course, easy for if you have your potential standardized. So this is just v over k squared times m squared. But these quantities you can directly express in terms of the Hubble parameter, the equation of state, the fraction in dark energy today, and k squared. And you find the mass is always of the order of h squared divided by k squared. So k squared is typically, for realistic cosmology, seems today a value that must be bigger than 1, otherwise you are in this early attractor. So there is very little escape to this simple conclusion that for these type of models, the mass is always of the order of the Hubble parameter. You see, you really need to go to extreme values of k, and there is that you would need an extreme fine tuning if you want to have a mass that is, let's say, much bigger than the Hubble parameter.
Phi goes from 0 at the Planckian Hilbert so to 200 and something, right?
Phi goes to infinity, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's say 0 at the Planck scale to.
The present value is 200 and something. And this is yes. Crucial because you have the Planck mass in front of the potential and you want to.
Sure. Yeah.
How does it go so far? I mean, is abdominal scalar field usually.
It just holds,
doesn't work very much.
No, it's. Go back to this chi language. So this chi just rolls up the potential, rolls up the potential, rolls up the potential. There's nothing, if you want, qualitatively changing. That's all what happens. And this just tells you that the potential energy divided by the force power of the Planck mass gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And expressed in this after a while scaling, the field phi just goes, and the asymptotic value of the potential is at 0. So if you wait long enough, the potential is small enough. Very simple.
So isn't that true that in these kind of models, not only the cosmological constant goes to 0, but any mass scale goes to 0?
No. This is just the issue. If you have to guarantee that the particle physics mass scales, that they evolve at least to very good approximation proportional to the Planck scale. So in a sense, you need a model where all the particle physics mass scales are linked to the Planck scale. This is not so crazy. I give you a simple realization. Just assume the Planck scale is identical with the unification scale. So the only thing you have to guarantee is that the unified gauge coupling in the grand unified theory does not depend on chi. Let's say it's attracted to a fixed point, alpha goes to 1 over 40 or something like realistic, then of course lambda QCD will move exactly together with the Planck scale, and the ratio of lambda QCD over M Planck will be fixed. So it's this type of model that you should have in mind, where the changing Planck scale tracks along all other particle physics scales.
But not the
cosmological constant, because this is given by this fixed point behavior. It's still given by a dimensionless ratio, but this little lambda is governed by a fixed point behavior, and it goes towards this fixed point at lambda equals zero. So in a sense, the difference is that the fixed point, if you think about it in terms of renormalization flow and fixed points, that the fixed points for the particle physics couplings, let's say alpha and so on, they should be at a non-zero value, whereas the fixed point for this phi to the 4 coupling, for this chi to the 4 coupling, that should be at zero. And then the behavior is different, because one of the particle physics scales, they all settle to constant values, but the cosmological constant goes to zero.
Okay. So, finally, I can protest my separation, by the way. I have a conceptual problem. Uh-huh. And the problem is the following, right? Let's say, whatever the history was, let's say I grant you that the history was we were changing continuously, masses were changing, Planck scale was changing, lambda stayed behind by some reason, uh-huh. right? Uh-huh. Now, today, we are changing very slowly, right?
It depends on your frame.
Well, overnight we didn't change.
No. I'm also serious. This is not a physical statement that we are changing slowly. It depends on the frame. It depends on, no, not in any frame. In the Weyl frame, in the Einstein frame, we are not changing at all.
Okay, very good.
And in the Jordan frame, we are changing
very
like mad.
Let's go to Einstein. Right. So we are not changing there. Okay. So then standard model, so the cosmological constant problem at the end of the day is a problem of the standard model. It's not a problem of some toy model. I mean, obviously, if you grant me to write toy models, I can write hundreds of toy models which have no cosmological constant problem. Take standard model, supersymmetrizing, there is no cosmological constant problem. So, but in the standard model, the way we know it, standard model has a cutoff TV. And if I compute corrections to the cosmological constant from the standard model particle, they give me TV to the fourth. And now, given this one, there is a problem, right? I mean, I don't understand how you can assume that the lambda stays behind, because I can compute lambda today, right? If I compute loops, today they give me TV to the 4, right? So this is what I don't understand. I mean, there is some... So I understand that in these toy models that you are presenting, everything may be fine, yes, because, you know, either you have some matter which is almost conformal or something like that, but at the end of the day, you have to go to the standard model, and that's my problem.
Well, I think this was just my point, that it's not the standard model that is relevant for this issue of if this fixed point exists and if it has an anomalous dimension or
not.
Not
for that issue, but for the cosmological.
No, but this is the issue that is relevant for the cosmological constant issue. It is only that. You do not need any other assumptions. You just need the assumption that this your potential at the end increases less fast than chi to the 4. And my argument is the standard model fluctuations, they just give a tiny, tiny contribution to these questions. You cannot, of course, if you would go now simply saying, if you would now simply go and saying, okay, I make a rough estimate, my lambda QCD scale is proportional to the Planck scale, so I should get something like chi to the 4. This just assumes that you have dilatation symmetry, and you just get you just lose the information that you have actually a fixed point in lambda. I think it's just not possible. You cannot just go and say, let's compute. You cannot compute.
But we
can't.
It's finite.
No, There are some theories that do not fulfill this criteria for sure.
Those have to do with UV completions of the standard model. You cannot blame. You see, there is a contribution from the standard model,
yeah,
which is certainly QE to the fourth.
No.
About that, something may happen.
No.
And, so sure.
No, this was exactly my argument before.
Yeah.
You want to know if this lambda has a fixed point. You want to know, for example, if this potential goes less fast than chi to the 4. So now this gets, of course, some standard model contributions. But it gets dominantly contributions from the modes that have momenta of the order of the Planck scale. And the standard model contributions are only a tiny fraction. They are a fraction of 10 to the power minus 40 or something like that.
But that's not enough. That's my problem.
No, this is not enough because you would now just simply say, okay, I have one contribution. I naively estimate they must be tied to the 4, and therefore the value that I give you is where we finally arrive is much too small. But if you would do that in statistical physics, you would say all fixed point calculations are wrong. Because for fixed point calculations, just a very characteristic property is that the individual contribution, the naive estimate of some individual contribution to some deviation from a fixed point is always completely wrong. Because an individual contribution can never account for the fact that a fixed point is reached as an effect of the flow. Just try it in an arbitrary statistical physics model, where you have a fixed point related, let's say, to a second order phase transition. The fixed point predicts you, for example, very precisely the value of the 5 to the 6 coupling and so on. You have a multi-component theory. And now you would just say, OK, I compute the typical order of the deviation of this coupling from its fixed point value by this single contribution. You would come always orders of magnitude too big. Because the fixed point is always an interplay between different contributions. And if you run to a fixed point, what you realize is actually a dynamical cancellation between different contributions, where every individual contribution is much bigger.
So you're talking about the infrared fixed point?
I'm talking about the infrared fixed point. The infrared fixed point from the perspective of the higher dimensional unified theory. This is exactly the point here.
Yeah, but that's precisely my problem, that you are doing it that way. Because my problem is that your theory, FQE, should change the regime, or somewhere, right? I mean,
You don't have the picture yet. Look, we have here this scale of transition from higher dimensions, so let's call that d bigger than 4, and d equals to 4.
Yeah,
and now we have here, let's say, lambda QCB, or TEB, or Fermi scale, something like that, TEB, whatever you want. Now we want to know how our theory reacts if we move this scale here a little bit. So of course, this scale will also move here. So in principle, you get now contributions of different thresholds. You get contributions because of this, let's say, Kaluza-Klein modes and all that. And you get a very, very tiny contribution from here. Because here, these masses here, they are given by, let's say, 10 to the power minus 20 times chi. So since this goes with the fourth power, they give a contribution, but a very, very tiny contribution. And you will never be able to judge how the overall potential changes with respect to chi if you do not understand what happens with these modes at the threshold between higher dimensions.
Sure, you can always say that somehow UV theory conspires so that exactly cancels the standard model contribution. That I agree. I mean, you can always
But this conspiration has done, if there is a fixed point.
But you didn't show that. You showed it in the Tony model, in which is not a standard model. And I agree.
Yeah, you're right. I'm saying if there is a fixed point, then this fixed point explains the cancellation.
That I agree with you.
If there is no fixed point, if the potential, for example, is allowed to go from positive phi to the 4 to an unstable, if that is allowed, then, of course, if this would be the situation, then your fluctuation would just run through lambda equals to 0, and you would find a very unnatural situation that lambda should be 0. So the crucial point is really that you are not allowed to change your potential from a from a well-defined theory into an ill-defined theory, that lambda is not allowed to pass through zero. And then you have a fixed point, and then the fixed point is responsible for cancellations, but now realized in a dynamical way.
What you're claiming is that...
We come out at 11:15, and you have one person discussion. Please make the...
Okay.